It's Adventure Time with Orson Annie. Mighty exciting for Annie these days. What's going to happen to her tonight, do you suppose? Well, until it's time to find out, let me ask you this. What's happening to you these days? Having lots of fun? Believe me, I know some folks that are in for some fun. Those early bird friends of Annie's, who've already sent for their new 1940 model Orphan Annie shake-up mug. You know, all of Annie's friends who drink sweet chocolate-flavored Ovaltine can get these swell new shake-up mugs free. And boy, are they beauties. Wait till you see them. They're made of genuine beetleware in brand new colors. A beautiful deep green and a bright, flashing scarlet. And every mug has a big colored picture of Orphan Annie and her dog Sandy right on the front. And don't forget, this shaker-upper is a two-in-one kit. When you put the top on, it makes a keen shaker for mixing your ice cold, chocolate-flavored Ovaltine shake-up. And then, when you take the bright red top off, presto, the shaker turns into a swell big drinking mug, holding a creamy, bubbly shake-up all ready for you to drink. Man alive, what fun you'll have with that new shaker-upper. Playing the shake-up game with your friends, having shake-up parties, making a picnic out of every meal this summer. Think of having a delicious ice-cold shake-up drink anytime you want it, made with fresh cold milk and sweet chocolate-flavored Ovaltine. What a treat on a warm summer day. And, of course, Mother will be glad to have you fix all the shake-ups you want, because she knows how much extra pep and energy food there is in every single Ovaltine shake-up. Loads of extra vitamins and minerals and other things everybody needs to be healthy and husky the way we all want to be. So, here's the thing. Annie wants all her friends to have one of these swell new 1940 model shake-up mugs, and you want to get one, I know. Especially when Annie has fixed it so fellows and girls who drink Ovaltine can get one absolutely free. Even though our regular price is 50 cents. So, listen closely. Here's what to do. Sit right down after tonight's adventure and print your name and address plainly on a piece of paper. Send it in, along with a thin metal foil seal from under the lid of a can of sweet chocolate-flavored Ovaltine. Mail it to Orphan Annie, Chicago, Illinois, and she'll send you your new 1940 model shake-up mug absolutely free. Now, don't put it off, will you? Ask Mother to get you a can of sweet chocolate-flavored Ovaltine right now and send in that seal for your free shake-up mug tonight. Mail it to Orphan Annie, Chicago, Illinois. Annie's sorry, but she can offer this wonderful free shake-up mug only to her friends who live in the United States. But if you do live in the United States, send in tonight. And now, our adventure with Annie.
I better explain just which little orphan Annie you are. Why don't you tell them? Your name is Janice Gilbert, but with which one were you?
The second and final.
Well, you know there were three.
No, there were three. There was one before Shirleyville, or in between?
Well, there was one at the same time. Now, I just found this out myself.
I never knew that. I'd never heard either one of them.
Well,
except
there's
on record.
Book published recently called The Serials, and it's a very detailed book, quite interesting, on radio, the radio serials. And it explains that at the time Shirley Bell, in the very early days when Little Orphan Annie was coming out of Chicago, began in 31, it may have been the first few years. There was another show with the same script, with a completely different cast, that would broadcast out of San Francisco. The reason for that was that network radio wasn't set up
the way it is today. The coaxial cable, whatever.
They call it coaxial cable. I think that's television, but whatever it was, it was done out of San Francisco. It was exactly the same show, which, and they brought this up in the book.
I never knew that.
That's the reason that a lot of Little Orphan Annie fans are very confused about voices on the old recordings.
Yeah, that's funny, because I never knew that myself, but I had never even heard the one from Chicago, except when they played records during the auditions. But I certainly thought that was the only one.
Well, in spite of the fact that Janice Gilbert is sitting here sipping ice water out of an Ovaltine mug, which isn't really fair, you weren't on for Ovaltine.
For Ovaltine, no. I was on for Quaker Oats and all their products, Quaker Puffed Wheat, Puffed Rice, Sparkies, and so forth. And at the time that I did it, I had known that there was a Little Orphan Annie on the air, but I had never actually heard it. That was some years before. So the sponsor ran auditions all around the country for somebody that would sound like that one. When I say sound like her, I mean have a certain quality, which was basically Midwestern in accent. So they played records for all the people who participated in the auditions, and I heard the record, and while I wasn't about to go ahead and try to imitate anybody because I sort of considered it beneath my dignity, I did see what he must have been looking for, and that was that Midwestern quality, which I did. I auditioned and then got the part. And then after I got the part, I told him I wasn't able to do it anyway, which was the case.
So what happened?
Well, I wasn't able to do it because I was doing between 12 and 13 shows a day on radio. That included repeat shows to the West Coast. Repeat shows were necessary because of the three-hour difference in time. So if we did a show, let's say, in New York that went on at 8 o'clock, which was a good time for the husbands who came home, it would be on at 5 o'clock at the West Coast. That would be too early. So we'd have to repeat it at 11 o'clock from New York and get it on at 8 at the West Coast. Well, I was doing so many shows that I had to run from one broadcasting station to another. And that presented a very difficult problem because I would be off the air, let's say, at 2:30 at NBC, which was somewhere, you know, in Radio City. And then I would go on the air at 2:30 at CBS, which was a couple avenues away and a few blocks. Now, how to get on the air at 2:30 at one place and be off at 2:30 at the other? Fortunately, there were commercials in between. So we would have an elevator waiting at NBC. And right before the closing commercial, I would run out. That elevator would take me down. And then I would run. Taking a taxi is no good because one red light would kill me. I'd run all the way across to CBS. There'd be another elevator waiting there. People to whisk me upstairs. And I would almost invariably get there just as the announcer was saying. And then, as Mary said to Jim, and I had very good breath control. I could control my breath, so fortunately I never sounded out of breath. But that was why I couldn't do Little Orphan Annie even after I received the part. So I explained this to the agency and the sponsors, and they said, well, we have to have you. We'll think of something. And they did. They taped it every Friday night. That is that we would do 5 records on Friday night, starting pretty late at night and doing them all night.
This
and
was a script show now.
This was a script show. It was 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And we would do those 5 records on Friday nights, and then they would play them some weeks later on radio. But the listening public would have assumed that it was live, although I think according to some law they had to sneak in something about taped or recorded or something.
When did you begin?
When
Little Orphan Annie?
I believe it started in the late 40s, but you know, I had been working so hard at the time actually doing these shows, all the different soap operas. Doing 12 or 13 a week is a lot, but doing 12 or 13 a day is sort of tremendous. And it isn't that I lost track of which one I was doing. I knew them all and all the different parts, but I certainly lost track of the dates and times as to when each one was on. I have a feeling that Little Orphan Annie started sometime in the late 40s and then continued for some years. So after I got the part and they started to record it, we did it, at night, every Friday night for quite a long time. And there were some interesting experiences that happened during that time. I had been working very hard and running back and forth. And in good weather, it didn't hurt me too much. But in bad weather, you know, I would get colds and things like that. I was pretty strong. But once I ran back and forth in a terrible snowstorm, got awfully wet and didn't have time to take a fur coat off. And it was hot in the studio. And that night, it was on a Friday, I had to go in and do Little Orphan Annie. And apparently I was very, very sick. I knew I was sick, but I didn't realize how sick I was. But, you know, the old adage, the show must go on. And even as a child, I knew it must go on. So I did the 5 records, and just about at the end of the 5th, I fainted. I was taken to a hospital, and it seemed that I had 104.5 fever and a strep throat. And I Took me a little while to recuperate in the hospital, but the records were done in advance, so Little Orphan Annie was safe, and the other soap operas rewrote their scripts until I could get back. But the strange thing was that some weeks later, when I listened to the show, I wanted to hear whether my voice sounded funny and hoarse that night. And I never listened to myself, but this time I did listen to a couple of them, Little Orphan Annie. And I didn't remember one thing that happened in those scripts. And an actor really never forgets. When you do a story, you remember it in your subconscious or partly in your conscious. You remember every bit of the story. I didn't remember one drop of that storyline, so I must have been actually taping the show in delirium.
That sounds like the sort of a thing, the spirit that Little Orphan Annie had, though. She would have gone right on.
Oh, yes, she had to go on, and who was I?
Were you pretty familiar with the character before you did it? Did you read it in the comic strips?
I'm sort of ashamed to admit that was not one of my favorite comic strips, and I never read it, except before I did the part. Before I started doing the part, I started to read it, and I thought she was an incredible little girl. I remember one thing that used to drive me crazy was that she didn't have eyeballs, and she still doesn't. And I used to think, my goodness, when I go to do personal appearances for the sponsor, which I used to do for their sales conventions all the time, will they be surprised when they see me without eyeballs? And will I have to come in that horrible red fright wig? As a matter of fact, the sponsor did insist that I dress for the part when I did public appearances. I had to wear a little red dress with white collar and cuffs. I think Little Orphan Annie must be 90 or 100 by now, and she never changes. She always looks the same.
Did you have a Sandy with you?
No, but the Sandy on the show is the greatest thing of all times. He was a man, and you wouldn't believe his name. His name was Brad Barker, and that was no joke at all. His name was really Barker. He was born with that name, and I think that gentleman, who was about, 6'2" or 6'3", great big husky man, must have made thousands a week, doing nothing but barking like a dog and meowing like a cat and doing various snakes and monkeys and cows and so forth. In other words, he was an animal actor.
Someone has mentioned him on this program before, and they didn't know his name, so I'm glad you brought it up.
He was terrific, and he took it so seriously, he almost thought like a dog, or like a cat, whichever he was doing. And I remember, you know how carefully radio shows had to be timed. Little Orphan Annie was a 15-minute show, 5 times a week. And they had the commercials beginning and at the end, and you had to be right on the nose. So during the rehearsal, if you happened to do your dress rehearsal and find that you were a minute over or 30 seconds over, you had to cut. And occasionally the director would cut a part that included some of the arfs and barks and things of Sandy. And Brad Barker, who was very zealous of each little bark that he did, was very upset each time something got cut, and he used to try to get some of the barks put back in another part of the show where they weren't, to start with. And I remember he was so serious, and the rest of us used to get hysterical but control ourselves. Once they had cut a big part of his barking and whining out, and he turned to the director and he said, "You know, since you took all of that out on page 7, I see a very good spot on page 9 where we could put back some barks. And right here, all during Annie's speech to Dandy Warbucks, how about a few short pants?" And he was dead serious. You know, he used to say, "Can we put in a few short pants here?" And nobody wanted to laugh because we could see he was completely serious, but used to kill us. He was a great guy.
I must have him on here for an interview.
Oh, you must. I hope he's still alive, because when I was a little girl, I remember him as being sort of a middle-aged man. So he might not be around. I hope he is.
Let's put in one of the things from a new album called The Themes Like Old Times. I say new because there was one out about 2 years ago, and I used a lot of the cuts from it, but this is a brand new one. It's Volume 2, Themes from Old Time Radio, and I'm going to use, right here, we're going to put in Inter Sanctum. People are always asking me about Raymond, whose real name was Raymond Edward Johnson, who was the Raymond, the host on Inter Sanctum.
Oh, I knew Ray Johnson very, very
lovely
well.
Lovely man. He's out in New England right now. He's
spooky looking.
He's been very ill.
Mm-hmm. When I say spooky looking, he was a good looking man, but he was sort of tall, slender, and sort of sinister looking, at least when he did that part.
Well, for the younger listeners who don't remember it, and for older listeners who want to hear it again, here's how Inter Sanctum sounded on the air.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mystery. Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host to welcome you in through the squeaking door to another half hour of horror. Come in, won't you? Sit down. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't get up, but I'm terribly tired. I spent last night with a friend who's a book collector, specializes in bestsellers. He certainly showed me some interesting ones. In fact, he tried to bury me in one. Because all the very best sellers have corpses in them.
That was the voice of Raymond Edward Johnson, who I'm happy to say is still with us, and I think he's in New Hampshire. Was Captain Sparks on Little Orphan Annie when you were doing it?
Yes, Captain Sparks was played by Carlton Young, who's one of the best-looking men I've ever seen, and I imagine he's in movies now. I've seen a few movies with him in it. Yes, he played Captain Sparks. But that part didn't appear in the comic strip, as you will know if you read Little
Orphan Annie. It didn't appear on the original series either.
Probably not. No, this was just put in for the Quaker pitch. But Daddy Warbucks and Punjab and Asp, they all appeared. Daddy Warbucks was played by Floyd Buckley, who also plays Popeye the Sailor in movies, you know, the voice of Popeye the Sailor in the cartoons.
I'm just looking over my notes here, Miss Gilbert, and I see that it was Floy Hughes who played the Little Orphan Annie role in the San Francisco cast.
Yes, and I had never known there was another Little Orphan
Annie. Well, I understand she's still out there in San Francisco.
Really?
Yeah, and the woman who played it in, I guess she was a girl who played it in Chicago, in the original version, was Shirley Bell, and
uh-huh.
She's there, and she's a housewife. I saw a newspaper article on her recently. Did you ever meet Harold Gray, who wrote the column?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
did
of course.
Did he supervise scripts?
No, not at all.
No?
No. As a matter of fact, he used to get very upset at some of the sequences we would do. We sometimes got in trouble a little bit with some of the sequences because we would do things in advance of current news because we taped in advance, and sometimes we would do certain plots that involved international situations because Little Orphan Annie was always, you know,
she
winning
a
war.
Everything.
She was into everything, you know, high finance and everything else. She was 10 or 11 going on 110, you know. And occasionally we would do things which were perfectly safe and innocuous at the time, but some weeks later when we were about to put them on the air, something had actually come up in world affairs that made this too significant, and we weren't permitted to do it. And then Helter Skelter, the writer, would have to write 5 new scripts or 10 new scripts, and we'd have to go in not only Friday night, but Thursday night and Sunday night and tape them all over again.
Did you have offers? You know, a box top from Quaker Puff Rice?
Oh, yes, of course.
What were they? Do you remember what we got? I never got my Ovaltine shaker, by the way.
Oh,
you've
what
been
you
Shirley
got,
Bell,
yes.
I'd have raised hell over that because I never got it.
No, I see you have one on the table. In
well, that's the mug, the Little
that's
Orphan
mug.
Annie mug.
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't remember what we gave away, but it was probably, oh, I don't know, things like guns that with laser beams or something, you know, I don't remember. It was anything and everything.
There was a Little Orphan Annie cockpit. Do you remember that?
I remember that vaguely. I think that was on our show. Yes, not on the one
I never
Chicago.
Even sent for that.
Yeah. I used to take pictures with the... You didn't send for that? Well,
no.
Shame on you. Maybe you'd grown
no,
too
I
big
was
at
never
the time,
into, into flying. Didn't interest me at all. But that shaker I'd still like in case Shirley Bell is
Little Orphan
is
Annie was
in.
Able to do everything on the show. She really did amazing things. She was constantly being stuck in quicksand and flying planes herself when needs be. And
she was the only girl heroine that I know of on the air. All the other characters were for boys, you know, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, and Superman.
Yes, that's right. She was the only girl. And, other shows from the comic strips actually went on, and I remember that all of them that came from New York, I did all the girl parts on. Terry and the Pirates went on, and in changing my voice from plot sequence to plot sequence, I did all the girls. The Dragon Lady never appeared, so I never did that. Then Gasoline Alley went on, of course. I was 9 o'clock, and bringing up Father. I was the daughter, Rosalie, on that. I was getting so sick of the comic strips, you know.
What kind of money could an actress like you have made on network radio?
Well, there was a scale, AFRA union fee, and of course when you did the leads, you didn't get scale, you got more. So each show would pay upwards of, I don't know, $500 or something, $400 or $500.
You mean per week?
Yes. Oh, well, that's if it was 50. That would be about the minimum that you could make on a
weekly
15 minute. It would be about the minimum. But then there were the half-hour shows they paid much more. I did a lot of the half-hour ones, too. There was one show that was on for years that I'm sure your listeners all saw and heard first. First in radio, then it went to TV, and that was Break the Bank with Burt Parks. I also did it with Bud Collier. I was called Janice the Paying Teller, and I gave away millions of dollars on that show. That was the first audience participation show. Then all the other ones came after that. But this one continued through all of them and was on right to the bitter end. And that was on once a week on television at night, but it was also on five times a week on television during the daytime. That was with Bud Collier during the day and Burt Parks at night. I did all of those. And other shows that I did first on radio, soap operas like the O'Neills. As soon as television came about, it went onto television, and then I did the television version. My True Story was first radio and then television. But the O'Neills is one I'll never forget because that makes me think of how different TV is today from what it was then. So far as the viewers were concerned, it was the same then. They'd watch their stories, everything was great. But for the actors, it was torture, and it killed many of the men actors. And I'm using that term literally. I can't tell you how many men I knew who died of heart attacks in the beginning.
Now, this was all live then, wasn't it?
It was live. Now, let's take a show like The O'Neills, which was on 5 days a week in radio, and I starred as Peggy O'Neill. Well, I went on to TV, and it was an hour one night a week. I forget which night we were on. Well, an hour show in television has literally dozens and dozens of pages of dialogue. And you had to memorize all of that. And frequently, you didn't get the script until 2 or 3 days before the show, and then you started rehearsals. Well, that wasn't so bad, because most of the actors had good memories, and you could memorize anything. But the thing that was bad was that they did it all at one time, live, instead of as they do them today, when they film them in advance, and each scene of maybe 30 seconds or a minute, they sometimes spend a whole week doing. So you do one scene, and then you stop, and a week later you do another scene. But then we did them all in sequence. And there were time changes in those sequences and costume changes. So while you were sitting watching at home, you would just see Peggy O'Neill, for example, sitting on a beach in a bikini, and then she'd say, oh, I wish I were in Paris. And 2 seconds later, she'd be in Paris dancing in a nightclub in an evening gown. Well, looking at home, that seemed perfectly natural. But doing it live, you had to actually get from one set to another in a matter of seconds in a different costume with a different hairdo. Well, the writers were really sort of idiots, or else the most inconsiderate people in the world, because they didn't write the shows with that in mind. And a typical O'Neill show would go this way. Peggy O'Neill would have a dream in the beginning. That would be the story for that hour. In that dream, she pictured herself as the wife of a Maharaja, as a girl working in Paris, as another girl in Holland, and so forth. And we would go from one of those sequences to another, all in different costumes. So as soon as we would finish one sequence with Peggy on an operating table, let's say, saying, oh, I wish I were somewhere else, the next scene, I would be in Paris, but what would happen in the studio is this. Some very strong male arms would grasp me bodily and throw me onto a dolly, that's a moving truck, push me into the next set where I would be in Paris, let's say. At the same time, a couple hairdressers and dressers, they're people who pull your clothes on and off, would be grabbing me, tearing me limb from limb, changing my hair, changing my costume, and throwing me into the next scene. All that took 2 or 3 seconds, but tore me apart. In the meantime, through all this manhandling, I'd have to remember my lines. And we would underdress. I don't think the viewers would know what that means, but underdress means that you would have your costume for the present scene on and other ones over it, on top of it. So you'd get literally peeled, you know, like a tomato. They'd peel one costume off, and then you'd be in the next one, and they'd peel that one off. Well, fortunately, the writers were this considerate. They had me in the bikini in the last scene, because after peeling that, we wouldn't have had anything left. But this was okay for the girls. The girls are very strong, you know, much, much stronger than the guys. But this killed the men. They couldn't stand it, and one after another had heart attacks, what with the heat and memorizing the lines. Most sponsors wouldn't let you look at what we call idiot cards, either. You just had to memorize it. That was it.
I've got some more Little Orphan Annie questions for Janice Gilbert, but before we get into that, I want to use another cut from the Themes Like Old Times radio album. This is how a program began. It was one of my favorites. I think it was as much as popular with adults as it was with kids at the time. It ran for a long time. I always remember it on CBS. It's called Escape, and this is the way it sounded.
You are isolated on a remote plantation in the crawling Amazon jungle, and an immense army of ravenous ants is closing in on you, swarming in to eat you alive. A deadly black army from which there is no escape.
We offer you Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Tonight, we escape to the Amazon jungle and to a creeping, crawling terror, as Carl Stevenson told it in his famous story, Leiningen versus the Ants.
That was the beautifully remembered radio show from the 1930s and 40s, Escape. Did you have, when you were doing Little Orphan Annie, did they use the famous theme, She's a Little Chatterbox with Curly Little Auburn Locks?
Yes, yes. A male voice used to sing it. Who can it be?
You couldn't do it for me, could you?
Well, it was done by a man, and you know, it was done on a record. Actually, we were waiting for our cue line in the beginning, I remember a record playing in the background, which was piped in from somewhere, the control room, and it was a male voice singing about who's the little chatterbox, the one with pretty auburn locks, who can it be, but it ended with, arf goes Sandy, and at that point, Sandy, Brad Barker, would let out a loud arf.
The last line I remember was, wouldn't it be worth your while if you could be just like Little Orphan Annie?
Yes, and I can't think why anyone would have thought that, radio-wise or comic strip-wise.
Was Joe Corntassel on your version? He was the shy kid who had the crush on Annie. He was
No, there was no other child on Little Orphan Annie.
He was played on the original version by Mel Torme.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Mel Torme?
Yeah, yeah.
When you say the original version, the one in Chicago
or California?
The one
that came from Chicago.
No kidding. No, there were no children on Orphan Annie. I don't think she ever played with a child.
What network were you on here?
I don't remember whether it was Columbia or NBC. I really don't. It was one of the two.
How about AHA, the Chinese cook?
Yes. Yes, I don't remember who played it. He was on. And the Asp was on. You know, that sinister-looking but nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
And Punjab, the great big giant, you know, with the turban around his head.
Well, you were a little girl when you did this, though,
yeah.
Really. You were a kid. Well, was it fun?
Oh, it was fun. I loved doing Little Orphan Annie. I really did. I thought going in there at night, and the director was a man called John Dietz, who was delightful. Everybody, it was really a lot of fun. Of course, all things were fun to a little girl. Even running from NBC to CBS to WOR in 30 seconds or something. I thought that was fun, too.
You were from Tompkins Corners.
Tompkins Corners.
Yeah, and Sunfield.
What's Sunfield?
Sunfield is another location for Little Orphan Annie, and I'm not really that familiar with the character, so I...
Yeah, well, it seemed to me that she was the great international everything. She was, during the sequences, she was all over the world. She was very rarely in America, it seems, in the sequences. We were always in the jungles of the Amazon or climbing a mountain.
She got
in
around,
Mexico.
Little Orphan
she
Annie.
She really got around.
How about
what
Mr. and Mrs. Silo?
That was that old couple.
The adopted parents.
They appeared for a very short time in the story. I think Parker Fenley, who was a great actor.
Played Mr. Silo.
I think he played Mr. Silo. I'm almost sure he did.
What was that story, I think we have time for, that you started to tell me before we began recording about, was it Ray Scott, who asked you to do a voice on his show?
Oh, that was so funny. I used to do a show for Raleigh Cigarettes, which was the Hildegard show. And I was Miss... Yeah, oh, God,
the deer that made Milwaukee famous.
Indeed. Well, I was Miss Everybody. Miss Chock Full of Nuts, Miss Raleigh Cigarettes, Miss Ayler's Coffee, Miss Everything. But as Miss Raleigh Cigarettes, we did it from a theater, and I was supposed to start the show and do all the commercials by going, Raleigh Cigarettes, Cigarettes, Raleigh cigarettes. Don't ask me why the lisp. That was their idea.
The
cute little lisping cigarette girl. And the orchestra leader at the time offered me an enormous amount of money if I would do something for him. And he said, really, this will... And the sponsor won't mind. I promise you he won't mind. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, I want you to go on, open the show after my big orchestral fanfare, and instead of saying Raleigh cigarettes, say Manischewitz matzah, matzah, Manischewitz matzah. Yes, I wouldn't do it. I said, I'll get in trouble. I don't think that sponsor has that great a sense of humor. But at later times, in retrospect, I think I should have done it.
WBAI, New York.
Would have been great.
Were there any shows you wanted to do and didn't? That you listened to and thought that would be fun to do?
Oh, there were a lot of shows that I couldn't do. There just wasn't time enough to do them all, even though a lot of the sponsors, when I couldn't do them, did what the sponsors of Little Orphan Annie did. They taped them in advance so I could squeeze them in. But I couldn't do them all. And I did all the children's parts, and then as I got a little older, all the adolescents, and as I started to do ingenue parts, I still maintained that quality of being able to change my voice back and forth from little girl to older woman. So I, even as I grew a little older, I still did all the children's parts.
Remember Manhattan Merry-Go-Round?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And all the shows like Mr. District Attorney, Death Valley Days, and all
those
shows.
It was Agnes Moorhead.
I did them all. Oh, Agnes Moorhead I worked with all the time.
Yeah, well, she was, what was her name on Death Valley Days?
But Death Valley Days was always a different story.
Well,
every week it was a different story.
I seem to remember her as a character that ran through it, though. I may be wrong.
I don't think so. No, it was on for 20 Mule Team Borax,
always,
I remember.
Always, on Friday nights.
Yes, and on Friday nights. Oh, exactly. What a memory. And I did all the girl parts, all the child parts.
And
Boraxo, of course.
Yeah. The reason I mentioned Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, I think I've got time for just one more of these themes. This is exactly how it was. What a ridiculous opening, and you'll hear what I mean when we play it, of Manhattan Merry-Go-Round. It was on for years on network radio. This is the way it sounded.
Merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
I've got a lot of people coming up on the program I will tell you about now. Alan Jenkins, fine character actor who worked in all those Warner Brothers gangster pictures in the 1930s. We recorded that out in Santa Monica, California, which is where he lives. And also, on my recent trip to Hollywood, I did a half an hour with Key Luke, who is Charlie Chan's number one son. Charlie Chan in the movies, that is. A program with Dorothy McGuire, and one that you should remember from your days in radio, Janice Gilbert, Vic and Sade. I interviewed Billy Idelson.
Yes. Really?
And I thought it's funny. I thought it was going to be a very funny show, because that was such a funny show.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't. For him, it was very nostalgic and a little sad, because he felt, in a way, I think, sort of related to both Vic and Sade. He played Rush Gook
on
the family.
That came from Chicago, I think.
Yes, all the time it came out of Chicago. We did a half an hour with him in California. He's very active in television now. And Patty Andrews, I recorded one with the Maxine Andrews, her sister, a few years ago, and she said, be sure to see Patty, because she's a totally different person than I am, or Laverne was. So we're going to be talking with her, and a boy by the name of Dennis W. Day, who you probably won't remember from his real name, but he was one of the original Mouseketeers on the Mickey Mouse Club. So we'll be talking with him about early TV. And Colonel Hubert Julian, who is in no way theatrical other than his manner, he was known as the Black Eagle of Harlem, very famous aviator. He flew for Haile Selassie and for the Finns against Russia during the Second World War. A star, big star in the silent films, and also in early talkies. I guess she's best remembered for Cat and the Canary in Silence, and in Talkies Showboat. Her name is Laura LaPlante. A double program Adele Juergens, who is on this program with her husband, Glenn Langan. He'd tell some very interesting stories about when Peggy Cummins was fired from Forever Amber and how it happened, how they told her about it. And Carlotta Monte, who was the mistress to W.C. Fields for so many years. She's written a book about it. She's going to be here telling us all about it. And a special Christmas show. I've scheduled this for Christmas because I think there are such wonderful feelings about One Man's Family. Did you ever hear One Man's Family?
Oh, yes, yes. That was a great show.
Well, you'll remember that on holidays, the Barber family always went to the Sky Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is a Sky Ranch.
Oh,
and
really?
And that's where Carlton E. Morse lives, and that's where we recorded it. It's up in the California Redwoods in Woodside, California, and it's a real nice show, so I thought I'd broadcast that on Christmas week. Anyway, I want to thank Janice Gilbert for being here and
It was lots of fun, Richard.
Why don't you come back and we'll do one on the O'Neills? Because people ask me about the O'Neills.
Really,
are some of the people that you work with still about?
Oh, I think so, yes. And that soap opera was on longer than any of them because it went from radio to television and ran the complete gamut.
You know, I think we should end this because we talked mainly about radio of the 1930s and 40s. We should end it with another one. Do you remember The Shadow of Fu Manchu?
Yes, but I have a feeling that didn't come from New York.
I don't know where it came from.
There was
from.
A show called The Shadow. Can't
yes,
can you remember
yeah.
The Shadow
oh,
Knows?
Sure.
Or
Lamont Cranston.
Lamont Cranston, yeah. But I think the other one must have come from California or Chicago.
Well, this was called The Shadow of Fu Manchu, and we're going to end with the opening of that show. I want to thank Janice Gilbert for being here. You live here in Manhattan,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do.
You're
still
active in television.
Yes, and I became the American bridge champion when I married my present husband, Tobias Stone, who was the world champion in bridge, and he turned me into a bridge player, life master, and I've played in all the Olympics representing America on their women's teams and women's pairs. So I'm concentrating a lot on that now.
Little Orphan Annie, a bridge champion.
Can you
think of it.
That is incongruous.
Think of it. Okay, I want to thanks very much for being here, and thank you for listening. This is Richard Lamparski. Before I say, I hope you all have a good evening, let's end with another opening from Old Time Radio. This is Sergeant Preston of the Northwest Mounted Police. Have a real nice evening.
Now, as howling winds echo across the snow-covered reaches of the wild Northwest, the Quaker Oats Company, makers of Quaker Puff Wheat and Quaker Puff Rice, the delicious cereal shot from guns, presents Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. It's Yukon King, swiftest and strongest lead dog of the Northwest, breaking a trail for Sergeant Preston of the Northwest Mounted Police in his relentless pursuit of lawbreakers.
And King, on you, Husky!
The adventures of Sergeant Preston and his wonder dog, Yukon King, as they meet the challenge of the Yukon.